Out in the Bay receives support from Project Open Hand, whose medically tailored food helps Bay Area residents recover from illness, get stronger, and lead healthier lives. Project Open Hand serves people with HIV/AIDS, heart disease, diabetes, cancer, and other critical illnesses. Learn more at openhand.org.
Welcome to Out in the Bay, Queer Radio. I'm Christopher Beal. There's a new show playing at the Magic Theater in San Francisco. It's called Deal with the Dragon. I was there opening night. It's really good. This one-person play tackles shame, the kind that cripples so many LGBTQIA people in our youth, and the scars that shame leaves behind.
When you are a queer person, chances are the systems that are in place that lead one to become a spiritual person, to know yourself spiritually, to love yourself in that way and be able to give love in return to others. Those spiritual infrastructures are often tied to a church, which often rejects you.
The creator of Deal with the Devil is Kevin Ralston. He's my guest this week, Out in the Bay.
Thank you.
Kevin, where did you grow up?
I grew up in literally the sociology textbook example of suburbia. It's a town called Levittown. There's three of them. And I grew up in the Pennsylvania one, north of Philadelphia.
What would you say your earliest memory of growing up in that town is? What do you remember when you really think about Levittown?
Well, since we're on Out in the Bay, I can go right for what popped in my head immediately, which was when Mark Miller, who was like, I was like 10 and he was probably 11, and we started playing behind the brick wall attached to my house and sort of just started bumping each other nakedly in a little alcove back there. And I was like, huh, that's interesting.
No, I have similar childhood memories right around the same age of my childhood best friend. Funny.
Yeah, how exciting. It was this moment of like, oh, what's this? This is an option. This is a thing.
Yeah, and then it's almost immediately dashed, and more on that coming up.
Yes, yeah.
How did you come out, and when did that happen?
I came out in college. I had a friend in high school, a very dear friend who was actually the maid of honor at my wedding, who tried to help me out of the closet in high school, and I shut that down. I just wasn't ready. I grew up in a very, very blue-collar, working-class, homophobic, racist environment. It really did not feel safe. But I started coming out once I was in college, when I was a senior, and it was just a couple of friends who were girls who I knew I could trust. It was kind of an agonizing process. And after college, I got this job teaching English in Germany in the Black Forest. And it was a year where I was completely removed from my culture, from my language, from all of these things. And it really was a beautiful time to be just meditative and really wonder about like, what's going on? What am I doing? How do I do this? And so the real coming out happened when I returned to America after that. I was probably like 22, 23.
Do you remember who you told first?
I think the first big one that I told was my friend Bruce, and we had been friends since high school. And he could tell I was launching into something. He's like, so you're coming out. You know? And in one hand, I was kind of relieved. But in another afterwards, like, well, you could have helped me out a little bit. You could have like thrown up a flare.
It's like the least helpful thing to say. I think a lot of queer kids can relate to finding community, finding expression in theater. What was your path into theater?
In high school, I did this thing called forensics. And some people have heard of it and some people have not. Forensics has nothing to do with medicine, at least in this context. It's a collection of categories in which you compete with your public speaking. And some of them are literal speeches, some of them are Lincoln and Doug debate, but the category that I did was the interpretation of literature, poetry, prose, plays. And I discovered this as a sophomore in high school, and I just like ate it up. So I was just devouring plays at a very, like pretty intense plays. So they like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf at the age of 14 or 15.
Goodness.
Yeah, it was, and it it really sort of, so here I was reading a whole lot of plays, but I didn't really have access to see them just financially. I didn't have that access. And so my first relationship with theater is on the page. And I realized I still really love that experience. I love, love, love reading plays. I love seeing them. I love rehearsing them. I love acting in them. But to be in conversation with just you and a playwright to me is a very, very intimate, exciting, cathartic joy in my life that We're drowning in books over here.
Talk a little bit about that path, though, because I think a lot of people, or at least initially, are kind of interested in just, you know, the onstage roles and being the star of a show. And I think it takes a unique person to discover not only an interest in, but a passion for that background work. Like, how did you find that?
When I returned from Germany, I decided that I was just going to move to New York. And I didn't have any acting training other than the work of reading plays and doing forensics. So I really had to, I got to actually put together my own kind of experiential learning, non-accredited MFA, and just sort of say, well, what do I want to study? What do I need to learn? So I would just like take classes all the time, just take classes on Shakespeare, take classes on diction, take classes on accents, take classes on physical movement. And all the while I had as a performance outlet, open mic nights. So that's what I did. I would do like stand-up as my first professional gig because I didn't know anyone. No one knew me. I didn't have any connections or resume or degree. So I just did open mic nights, which gave me a fearlessness that I really can trace back to that experience very, very clearly. And I was doing well. The only thing was, it wasn't my path. I was doing it. It was a means to another end. And so once I cracked into theater, I stopped doing it because that wasn't the goal. But I can look back now, say, for example, to the current project, Deal with the Dragon, and how a lot of that goes back to me just like writing, performing, writing, performing, writing, performing.
Do you have any favorite roles throughout your career in theater?
My favorite role, I ran to the theater for every performance when I got to play the gentleman caller in The Glass Menagerie. It was an absolute delight. And there's a couple reasons why. First, there's just the vintage, the period costume, which I just love, that 1930s suits and hats and stuff like that. And then there's the story of a sort of, you know, a poor family really struggling to make it, having the light shut off. And that really resonated with me because that was what my childhood was like, we lost our house, foreclosed upon. We often didn't have heat in the winter and, you know, getting groceries from people. But what I really loved most, and this is very vain, this is very ego, was, I don't know if you're familiar with the play, but the first act, the other three characters do almost nothing but talk about your coming. The gentleman, it's all about, when will he arrive? When will the gentleman caller come and walk through the door? And then, so when you walk on stage, the audience is like, there he is. There's the guy we've been waiting to see. And it's pretty, it was just a delight to perform. It was very easy and fun. I worked with the San Francisco Mime Troupe. And for those of you who don't know, that's not mime in the sense that you think of, but it's agitprop musical theater.
Good, because I was trying to figure out how miming was going to play on the radio.
Nope, not going to play. I wouldn't do that to you, Christopher. I would not do that to you. So they're a San Francisco institution, and the shows are just very silly, but the content and the point is very serious. Doing a San Francisco Mime Troupe show is like being on a roller coaster ride. It just careens before you, and it's the highs. It's a high.
Kevin, I'm always curious about the journeys that people take to end up here in San Francisco. It's sort of a mecca for queer people. What brought you here?
It was very special. I was living in Hawaii. I was a company member at the New Jersey Shakespeare Theater. And my sister was a traveling nurse in Hawaii, so I went to stay with her for a while. And island fever is a real thing. So I came to visit, to get off the rock after about 4 or 5 months, I came to visit a friend who had moved to San Francisco. And I just was completely entranced. I can't say that I fell in love with it so much as I was just dumbfounded by it. I had no box in which to place it. Like, nothing made sense to me here. Like, I didn't know how to interact, but it got under my skin. And then I did move back to New York, and not long after that, 9/11 happened. I had just moved into a sublet on 9/9.
Goodness.
And so after that happened, I was like, I think I might be done with New York, and I think I kind of want to move to San Francisco. And not long after that, after I made that decision, I met my husband. I met this fella in a leather bar on the Little West 12th, which is now like some super fancy outside mall at the bottom of the High Line. No leather bars down there anymore. We visited that recently. And anyway, so I was like, hey, you're neat. I kind of like you. I'm moving to San Francisco. Do you want to come? And we knew each other 6 months when we got on the plane. And so we're in the taxi leaving San Francisco SFO. And I look over and it was like the end of The Graduate. I don't know if you're familiar with the film, but you know what I'm talking about, where they escape. Like, he rescues her from this wedding. And then they get in this bus and they're like, we did it. And then they're like, who are you? I don't know you really. And that it really was a moment of panic, but we've been together almost 20 years now. So it seemed to be, I think it's the right decision.
Did San Francisco help your relationship grow stronger? Do you think it changed it?
You know, it's a really good question. I think I'll answer it the other way first and then answer it the way you've asked it, which is I don't think that we would have survived if we were in New York. Mm. There was just too much temptation. It's too easy to break up with someone, I think, in New York. We had some friends, but we didn't have like family. And because of that, we weathered some really, really hard times where I think if we had stayed in New York, that we might not have survived them. So, but in another way, your question is very, very, very intuitive, because San Francisco's recovery community is ultimately what saved my marriage. I got sober about 10 years ago, and it was because of the program community and my access to it and my love of the people I've met in there that I learned how to be a better husband. I learned how to be a husband at all.
Congratulations on your sobriety.
Thank you. Yeah, it's very precious to me. Thank you very much.
You touched on a theme that I think is really important for queer people. And I sort of hammer it on the show because I like to imagine some queer youth somewhere listening to this. Speak to the importance of queer family, because you talked about being in New York and having friends, but not having family. And I think a queer family is what you mean. Why is that so important?
Well, I always think about, is it Tennessee Williams who says it? The analogy is that if you take a look at a couple of trees, like two trees standing out on a hill, weathering the intense winds that come off the Pacific, at least as they do out here in the Richmond district where we live, those trees are more vulnerable just standing out there by themselves. Whereas if they're surrounded by other trees, they're just more stable. And I think that's just the simplest way into a pretty complex idea, which is just like, we're social creatures. You know, we have to have our families chosen or of origin around us. So for queerness, of course, and I got to do a little bit of work with this group called Outlook Theater Project years ago, where I got to go around and interview LGBTQ senior citizens, gather their oral histories, and then weave that into a narrative play called This Many People. We were building community through the project. And one of the side communities that we got to work with was Lyric. And Lyric, for those of you who don't know, I think they're still around. I actually don't know. But at the time, they work with queer youth. And a lot of queer youth are just, you know, homeless. And that was one of the plots of like, how does a person just, you know, it's like, congratulations, you survived. You got out of your family's, you know, toxic, homophobic, queerphobic, transphobic environment. But now you're here and it's not easy. You know, it's really expensive. And there's a lot of ways to fall through the cracks. For queer youth, thankfully, we do here in San Francisco have lots of institutions like the Center and like Lyric, that there is access to it, but who's guiding them there when there's temptations to get to go elsewhere, like the bar scene, there's nothing wrong with the bar scene, but it's just, it can be really tricky terrain if you don't have someone to guide you through it.
So much of your theatrical work has centered on the LGBTQIA community. You mentioned This Many People. You also played Charles Cooper in ACT's staging of Eight, the marriage equality play. Is that sort of LGBTQ subject matter sort of your happy place?
Yes, it's so important. Yeah, it is a good way to put it. It is a happy place because the purpose is so much greater. I did flounder for a number of years, trying to just like be a theater artist for hire, you know, and make a go of it, make a living of it. And it was just making me wildly unhappy. Hmm. I think it can be traced back to going to New York and just getting up and doing my own writing. So I already had that, like, you can do this. Like, you can just do whatever you want. And so I would do that. I would start by like writing my first play, Crystal Christian, which was in response to homophobic evangelical preachers who then get caught with a gay sex worker doing crystal meth. Like, whoops, you know, like that archetype that just doesn't seem to stop. You know, that archetype just keeps coming. And so that was, once I did Crystal Christian, and I was fortunate enough to get my friend Sarah Huddleston at the Magic at the time to do a workshop, a summer workshop production, I was like, when I went back to trying to be an actor for hire again, I just, the passion had gone out of it. And I was like, no, I have to be telling these stories. That higher purpose has to be there, or else I'm just earning a paycheck and it's not even a paycheck I can live on. So it became pretty clear that I had to be purpose driven from then forward.
You mentioned Crystal Christian, and the tagline of the show is about the hypocrisy of loudmouthed homophobes who get caught doing crystal meth with gay hookers. Ted Haggard, the megachurch pastor in Colorado Springs, who had a very public fall from grace in 2006 under identical circumstances, he was obviously the inspiration for this, yeah?
Yes, very much so. What happened was I was doing a play down on the Central Coast in a very conservative area, and I was escaping every week during the 4-hour drive just to spend 24 hours on my day off in San Francisco. And so I was listening to a lot of late night talk radio on AM dial down there. And they had these talk shows where young people were like, they sort of like bait them into talking about these feelings, and then they direct them, and they kind of passive aggressively shame them, and then direct them to go pray the gay away at this organization, which I think is called Exodus International. I was like screaming in my car at this outrage. The Ted Haggard thing broke like almost a year later. And I had been stewing on like, what am I going to do with this? What am I going to do with this? And once Ted Haggard broke, I was like, oh, well, this is my guy. This is my protagonist. Because it's almost Greek tragedy proportion. The fall from grace is so great. And the stakes are so high, it's just ripe for theater.
What did writing that show bring up for you? Did you grow up in the church?
I grew up Catholic. So it was there, but it wasn't so overt. On one hand, it was extraordinarily exciting because here I was doing it. You know, I was back to being in the driver's seat of the creative process. So that was extraordinarily thrilling. And what was also thrilling is that people were responding to it. I would mention it to friends and they were like, well, let's do a reading. And then we'd do a reading with my friends. And then Sarah Huddleston's like, hey, I got the keys to the magic. You want to do a weekend of shows and a workshop? So that was really exciting. But I also think that it was personally tilling the soil for the work that I would eventually do in recovery, the sort of like dredging up the shame that I had sort of boxed up and pretended I was fine because I live in San Francisco and I'm out. People know I'm gay and I'm a theater artist for crying out loud, but I hadn't done the work yet. And it is work because I came of age sexually at the height of the AIDS epidemic. And I was terrified. And the Catholic guilt had worked on me. And so I came out late. I didn't really explore my sexual being in a way that was sort of self-loving for a while.
Do you think the LGBTQ plus experience is adequately represented in modern theater?
Oh, gosh, no. Theater takes time. Theater is slow. If you take a look at, unless it's a New Works theater, you take a look at the average show and how old most of them are, because it takes a while to cultivate a playwright's voice. Fortunately, we live in San Francisco where there's so many theaters doing new works where you can, like say, for example, a Counterpulse that is really creating inroads for artists of all kinds, of all stripes. But no, theater is, it's slow. And yet we are spoiled here in that way. I think if anyone is doing it well, I do think that San Francisco is creating inroads to get the voice out there.
But do you think that in 2022, in sort of an on-demand world, that theater can afford to continue to be slow?
No. And afford is the right word. It cannot afford it. Literally, that's why theaters are closing.
The theater-going audience has been aging for a long time and has not True. Been being replenished by younger audiences. This is a fact that every theater across the country, possibly in the world, is facing right now. It's the availability of different types of entertainment is changing. So I guess the point I'm making is if Netflix can respond to something and have a documentary out in 3 weeks, can theater afford to take a decade to get a message out?
I lived in Germany. So I got to actually see some theater in Germany, and this was exciting work. Just like I had never seen, it just blew me away. And then I learned that's because theater is supported there. So I think the first step of this is that theater in America is utterly a commodity. like, let's talk to the subscribers and see what they want. Let's see what the board says about what we should have. Let's ask the audience to give the playwright some feedback on the work. It's like, well, how about instead just like train the artist and let them do their thing and trust whatever artist you're talking about. So for me, part of this comes back to like theater is going down because it took the power out of the artist's hands and put it fully in the hands of the ticket buyer. And one example of how it's also irrelevant is what you're talking about, which has to do with queerness. Is like, it's just another way in which theater is glacially slow.
How do we as theater goers and performers in theater, how do we affect that in the future? How do we help theater?
Oh, gosh, great question. Great question. For me, it always comes back to the playwright. Like, find a potential voice and invest in that voice.
I want to talk about your new show, Deal with the Dragon. It's a dark comedy running through mid-August at the Magic Theater in San Francisco. What is Deal with the Dragon about?
Ultimately, what Deal with the Dragon is about is shame, in this case, from growing up queer, and the rage that can grow out of that, and the numerous other problems that can grow out of that, of not dealing with it.
I recently read Alan Down's book, The Velvet Rage, and it changed my entire perspective on my upbringing, my sexuality, my relationships. It's a really powerful book that tackles the shame that we face growing up gay in a straight world. And these themes of shame are certainly weaved throughout Deal with the Dragon. Why is tackling sexual shame in this way so important?
First of all, I'm so glad you read it.
Oh, it's so good. It completely changed my life.
The same. It's like there is a sort of before and after for me with that book. Like there was my life before and there was my life after.
Yeah.
Well, I think the thing is that shame is a really tricky beast and it hides things from you. You know, there's the forward motion of shame, which whispers in your ear that you're not good enough, you're not okay, you're not going to be okay, you're wrong, you're evil, blah, 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 blah. But then there's this other sort of backfootedness to shame, which is about hiding things, like preventing you from looking at things, denial and blocking things out. And that's the really dangerous stuff, I think, because you don't know it's there. So you can't deal with it if you don't know it's there. Here's what's coming up for me now as we talk about this. When you are a queer person, chances are the systems that are in place that lead one to become a spiritual person, to know yourself spiritually, to love yourself in that way and be able to give love in return to others. Those systems, those spiritual infrastructures are often tied to a church, which often rejects you. And without those in the place, the spirit shrivels. And that's what's really tragic. It's not just the body, it's not just the mind, it's the spirit. And that's where practically all of the beauty and joy and wonder of life is. And so what I loved about the book, getting emotional here, is that it gives a very simple, accessible framework for tapping into what I know is spirituality, love of self, so that you can then be loving to others. And that's everything. And that's, I think, of the highest importance.
Is there a particular scene in Deal with the Dragon that you'd like to share with us?
Absolutely. I think if I were to pick one, I would pick scene 4, which is where the play really pivots. And it's where what I was just describing about Hunter coming forward and putting up a fight and sort of battling back really happens. And I'm very proud of it.
You know, Hunter, I've been thinking, if you are chosen today, what that would mean for us. It would mean that I don't need a guardian anymore. Right? I would miss you, terribly. But it is so clear to me now that this is what you want, so I will help you get it. And I insist, this is all that we do. We practice. I will be them. You, of course, are you. I will ask you questions. Hunter, an interview for something as prestigious as this, it is no simple matter. It requires certain traits. Self-awareness, self-promotion, and self-esteem. traits I do not think of when I think of Hunter Keegan.
Out in the Bay is supported in part by Project Open Hand, providing 2,500 life-saving meals and 200 bags of groceries daily to sustain people experiencing illness, social isolation, or the health challenges of aging. Learn more at openhand.org. Project Open Hand. Meals with love.
You're listening to Out in the Bay, Queer Radio. I'm Christopher Beale. My guest is gay playwright and actor Kevin Ralston. You're starring in your one-person show, Deal with the Dragon, through August 14th at the Magic Theater. Tickets are on sale now. As audiences experience this show, what do you most hope they take away from it?
What I think the show can really provide to people, if they're up for the imaginative leap that it asks or invites them to, is to be taken to a moment in their life, a pivotal moment, where they themselves were looking right in the mirror at their own stuff. Or they realized that they had set their life in motion all because of a decision they had made way back when. Or they realized that they were running on an old story. And to really like be taken back to that moment on a visceral level and see it anew. And realize that, you know, it's never too late to rewrite your own story.
Kevin, what are you working on after Deal with the Dragon?
When I wrote the Ted Hagger play, the literary manager at the Magic was like, it's so clear that you hate your protagonist. You need to rewrite with compassion. And I was like, that, I'm not doing that. I wasn't ready to have compassion for that character just yet because I hadn't done my own work. And this play, the character of Gandhi Schwartz, when I first was writing him, he was the embodiment of all the things about the gay community that I didn't like. The sort of the scene, the cattiness, the drugs, the gossip, all of that stuff. He was in the embodiment of that. And I noticed that he was also becoming a two-dimensional character whose job was to carry my resentments around. Mm. And I caught that and I was like, oh gosh, I'm doing it again. So I put him in recovery. And so just gather those characters together and just sprinkle compassion all over them and then watch what they do with one another.
Kevin, thank you so much for joining me on Out in the Bay.
Absolute pleasure talking with you.
You can catch Kevin Ralston in Deal with the Dragon through August 14th at the Magic Theater in San Francisco. We'll put a link in the show notes at outinthebay.org. Out in the Bay is supported in part by Project Open Hand, providing 2,500 life-saving meals and 200 bags of groceries daily to sustain people experiencing illness, social isolation, or the health challenges of aging. Learn more at openhand.org. Project Open Hand, meals with love. You can catch up on past episodes of Out in the Bay, get in touch or sign up for our email newsletter, even make a donation at outinthebay.org. Your donation helps us keep bringing queer air to your ears. Out in the Bay is a nonprofit, independent production, which means we rely on donations from listeners like you to keep the show going. You can make a donation. It's tax deductible at outinthebay.org. Thanks to Brad Payton and Richard Merck of Silicon Valley and Cornelia Enders of San Francisco for your generous support. Thanks also to KALW 91.7 FM and San Francisco Public Press's radio station KSFP 102.5 FM in the San Francisco Bay Area for broadcasting Out in the Bay each week. If you have an idea for an episode of Out in the Bay or someone you think we should interview, let us know. outinthebay@yahoo.com. That's outinthebay@yahoo.com. Our executive producer is Eric Jansen. I produced this episode with an assist from Jim Provenzano at the Bay Area Reporter. Our theme music is by Holly Mead. I'm Christopher Beale at Real Chris J. Beale on social media, and we'll see you next week out in the Bay or anytime at outinthebay.org.